got my zapper, so I'm happy. Well, thank you so much for coming. I'm really honoured that there are so many of Clive's friends, family here today. And because I kind of had a sense that people were here that would have heard me give the eulogy for Clive and perhaps read the piece that I did in the JQ or the TLS, I've tried to do something completely different in terms of my talk. But I'm kind of conscious, and I have been conscious looking through it over the last couple of days, that maybe there's not enough of Clive's narrative voice. There's a lot of Clive's voice when he gives interviews, so I've added a bit more of his narrative voice as well. Now, Clive and myself go back 35 years to 1983, to that famous moment when I was perched on his matrimonial bed, at the end of his bed, with my ghetto blaster, suitably enough, to recording an interview with him. And it was kind of typical of Clive that things were awkward, that he didn't in any way put me at my ease, and I think he wanted to push me just to see how I would react and where things would go, rather than act like the very, very successful author. Come in. I've only done. This is the first of about three introductions, so don't worry about it. Rather than act like the very successful author that he was in 1983. 83 was the list, the time when he was on the grant, the first grant of Best of British Writers list, Best of Young British Writers list. And he was there with Salman Rushdie, Kashir Ishiguro, Angela Carter. I mean, this was something that he could have lauded over me, far from it. Now, one of the last times I saw Clive was when we spent a week in Venice. And he's written memorably about this because in that week we managed to see six Shylocks. To be honest, we were two Mr. Magoos together, with one of the Magoos, that would be me, exploding at regular intervals. And all of this is recorded, I'm embarrassed to say, in one of the stories in Shylock Must Die, Shylock Our Contemporary. So I'm finally immortalised. I will read just the first page or two of this. And what I'm planning to do is start with a story from Clive, and I'm going to end with a story from Clive as well. "Admit it," I say to my father, "we're lost. How many more times do we have to cross the Rialto to convince you?" Mm-hmm. My father drops the handle of the case he's been wheeling, passes me the iPhone and says, "Okay, Marco Polo, you do better." Accepting the gender reversal without comment, I linger, waiting for Google Maps to rediscover us. As if springing from that empty pocket of existence, a man in a long black gabardine suddenly appears, only to jostle me aside. The coat is not noteworthy, for the day is scorching and the wearer is not an Orthodox Jew. But he's certainly in a hurry. Having pushed past me, he leaps upon the bridge's parapet as if goaded beyond endurance by the soft shoe shuffle of the impenetrable crowd and begins to exercise his freedom to run. Having reached the summit, he pauses and spreads his arms like the star of a musical about to deliver his climactic number. But instead of some rousing chorus, he issues a filthy imprecation and leaps feet first into the turbulent waters of the Grand Canal. Now I'm going to have to leave it up to you to find out what happens to the person who leaps into the Grand Canal. But I can give you a clue. The person that was representing me in the story did not leap into the water. So, Clive Sinclair and Philip Roth. I think like many British Jewish writers, and especially many British Jewish writers who write in the comic mode, they're haunted by Philip Roth. This is a 2016 interview, but exactly the same thing, the response occurred 35 years earlier in the interview, or 33 years earlier in the interview that I took from the bottom of Clive's matrimonial bed. You've been called the English Philip Roth. So this is Clive's response. Let me tell you a story. Not mine, but one I borrowed from the Hasidim. There was once a man who constantly measured himself against others. In the end, it got him down and he sought consolation among the Tzaddikim, men wiser than he. Joshua, said one, in the world to come they'll not ask you, why were you not more like Moses? They will ask you, why were you not more like Joshua? I think I've managed that in a few of my books, got to be more like myself. And Joshua Smolensky, we'll see, is a very important persona for Clive. It's the name that he would have kept if his family had stayed in Eastern Europe. Okay, so the third introduction. So this is the kind of thing I'll be talking about today. I'm going to start off just by looking at England, America and Jews, what both Roth and Sinclair say about them. I then want to understand what I call the diasporic turn, understand them both as diasporic writers, and why they were closest, I think, at this point. Both writers had what Clive called in a splendid book of his, diaspora blues. Diaspora blues. Clive had this throughout his life, and Roth had it when he was semi-exiled in London from the US for about 12 years during his middle period, from the late 70s to the 80s, throughout the 80s. I'll then look at the national turn in Roth's fiction, Monumental History, and I'll contrast Monumental History, the Monumental History of Roth, with the dodgy history of Clive. So Monumental versus dodgy, and we'll see Clive's consistency, but also change within his position as a diasporic writer. So, England. So the first quote is from the interview that I gave, that Clive and myself had, and we'll see that they have similar views. Roth and Sinclair have similar views until the very last quote. The very last quote. Essentially, and I'll read out the quotes, but essentially England is just a place to contemplate things, to recollect in tranquility, as Clive puts it. But Clive had to leave England, he says, to find something interesting enough to write about. I find no engagement with England at all. Everything there is a pale reflection of everything else. I feel that in England I'm on the sideline. One can imagine more interesting lives. And here he's thinking about Eastern Europe, or the Middle East and Israel, or America. England's a sort of staging post where after one's explored these possibilities, one can recollect in tranquility and write fiction that owes nothing to any English antecedents. And again, he talks about wrath, and wrath is important for him on the level of language, I think, in the second quote. That's the key point, what he calls a debased American Yiddish English, that this could be a literary language, a literary vernacular. Now, Roth has a very similar view of England to Clive, and when interviewed about, because he was living in England, so Hermione Lee says, well, you're living in England, you've been living here now for more than a decade, will you write about England? And Roth says, 20 years from now, I might be able to set a story in a wine bar on Kensington Park Road, but I'm unable to conceive myself writing on England because he's no cultural grievances with England, no cultural grievances with England. England doesn't affect him in any way, and this is very much Clive's position as well. Nothing drives me crazy here, and a writer has to be driven crazy to help him see. A writer needs his poisons. The antidote to his poisons is often a book. Now, this was Roth's position in 85, but it changed completely by 5 years later, and even before that. The quote from Deception, this is where the Roth figure says, I've never felt more displaced in any country than in England. And the climax to The Counterlife, one of Roth's best novels, 1986 novel, Zuckerman says that England's made a Jew of me in only 8 weeks, which on reflection might be the least painful method. A Jew without Jews, without Judaism, without Zionism, without Jewishness, without a synagogue or an army or even a pistol. A Jew clearly without a home, just the object itself, like a glass or an apple. So in the end, Roth did find his cultural grievances with England, and needless to say, it was English anti-Semitism. America. I'm going to talk about Clive very much as a quiet, quoting from someone else, as a quiet revolutionary writer. But one way of thinking about this is the way that English and American literature was seen as complete opposites, really, until Clive's generation. So the classical statement about this is Richard Chase, the American novel and its tradition. The American novel tends to rest in contradictions and among extreme ranges of experience, whereas the English novel gives the impression of absorbing all extremes, all maladjustments and contradictions into a normative view of life. Roth in some ways reinforces this when he writes on American literature and describes it famously as impossible, he says, to write about the American reality. He says it stupefies, it sickens, it infuriates, and finally it's even a kind of embarrassment to one's meagre imagination. So Roth, at this point, couldn't write the great American novel and couldn't write about American history in a monumental way. It was too much for the writer to encompass. And this was his position until his later fiction, until what I call his national turn. His national turn. Well, I'm going to quote from the anatomy lesson, but I talked to Clive about it, and Clive describes it as a kind of solipsism, except there's a certain intellectual... So we agreed it was solipsistic, so we agreed it was just about the self. And this is what Roth's always accused of is only writing about the self in relation to Zuckerman. But what Clive says is that in the anatomy lesson, Irving Howe gets his throat cut. It's just inconceivable. So Roth had a bad review from Irving Howe, so of course he parodies him and satirises him to death in the anatomy lesson. And again, people said, well, all Roth's doing is getting his revenge on a bad review. I mean, it's much, much more than that, because Irving Howe basically said that Roth isn't a Jewish writer and couldn't be a Jewish writer. What Clive says, it's inconceivable that that sort of argument could occur here in Britain, with the possible exception of George Steiner, but then he would be arguing with himself. Roth, finally, does, as I say, have his cultural grievances with England, and in the final quote he says, it's usually the Semites. So in other words, it was his fellow Jews that normally criticise him, not the anti-Semites, who assaulted me for being a Jew. Here in England, I was all at once experiencing firsthand something I'd never personally been bruised by in America. Okay, and the final triage of my third introduction is Jews. Now, Roth's view of Jews, I think, is completely different to Clive's. And Roth essentially thinks of Jews in relation to oppositions, good Jews and bad Jews. He says in Reading Myself and Others, ever since some of my first stories, my work has been attacked as a dangerous, dishonest and irresponsible. My critics often have a cramped and untenable notion of right and wrong, looking at fiction in terms of approval and disapproval of Jews. Positive and negative notions of Jewish life. But the world of fiction freezes from the circumscriptions that society places upon such fictions. Again, when it comes to Portnoy's complaint, and essentially Roth was criticised for his very first collection of stories, Goodbye Columbus, written in the 50s. So he was already criticised for misrepresenting Jews. So what he did in Portnoy's complaint, don't know, has anyone read Portnoy's complaint? Maybe there's brown bags here, aren't they? Undercover, something like that. He doubled down with Portnoy's complaint. He said, you think I've misrepresented Jews? You ain't seen nothing yet. So he doubled down. But again, even in Portnoy's complaint, he thought he was quite limited in the way that he thought about Jews. He says that I found in the troubled Anne Alison the voice that could speak on behalf of the Jew boy, so aggression, appetite, marginality, and the nice Jewish boy, repression, respectability, social acceptance. And once he put these two stereotypes together, he was able to complete Portnoy's complaint. And of course, the very definition of a Portnoy's complaint, I don't know if anyone's got it in the room, is a disorder, I probably got it to be honest, in which strongly felt ethical and altruistic impulses are warring with extreme sexual longings of a perverse nature. That's kind of interesting, because I am going to talk about the ethical dimension to Clive's fiction, but I'm not sure ethics in Clive's, perhaps it does always, perhaps Clive had Portnoy's complaints, I haven't thought of that. Okay, well, we'll see. You can judge for yourself. But the ethical dimension certainly is incredibly important for Clive. And it wasn't just opposed to extreme sexual longings, although perhaps it was in his early stories especially. But also it was opposed to Jewish history. So in The Brothers Singer, Clive argues that both Isaac Bashevis Singer and Philip Roth made it apparent that Jewish writers who turns a sordid tale into art have to choose between their talent and their people. Both authors chose their talent and thereby contributed to their father's deaths, or so the fiction would have us believe. Such patricidal guilt is complicated by Jewish history, in which the naive desire to murder the father was made hideously real by the Nazis. So Clive, I think, in The Brother Singer, but more importantly in his fiction, and also I think in his life as well, had a tremendously ethical view of relationships, of his own writing, but also of his friendships as well. And I think this was because of history. It may also have been in opposition to extreme sexual longings, but Heidi's here and I wouldn't dare to go along to go into that territory. But maybe we'll speak afterwards about that. All right, and for the people that came late, don't worry. That was my third introduction and I've just finished it. So I'm actually starting now. So, Clive Sinclair, the quiet revolutionary. This was a quote which I've always found helpful. Clive Sinclair instigated a quiet but profound revolution in British Jewish letters. And I need to, in many ways, what I want to tease out is why that's the case in the lecture. Clive's sensibility, I think, his voice, can be summed up in this quote, the next quote. He says, "I was born at a time when English history had run its course." So he's talking here, he was born in 48. "And I remained unmoved by the end of empire. My writing is a search for a place in which I may feel at home, where my literacy will not be in question. Perhaps there's something to be gained from having a language but no history." So he means English, but no interest in English history. "A history but no language." So here he means Jewish history in what he calls a national sense, but no language. He hasn't got much Hebrew, he hasn't got much Yiddish. He's got some. "From being an outsider in England, Poland and Israel. But in such moments as I'm experiencing now, as I attempt to find words for my alien thoughts, I think how nice it would be to feel at home in this world, to be really Joshua Smolensky." So it's this tension between imagining alternative histories, alternative identities, on the one hand, and a search for authenticity, to really be Smolensky, to really feel at home, that I think sums up his sensibility, certainly as a writer. Again, "I have a dual loyalty," he says, "to the language of England, the history of Israel. I write..." Now, he writes in the present tense. This is the interview, the Sinclair Gear interview. It's online. You can find it. In many ways, it's Sinclair's, I think of it as Clive's self-obituary. He kept adding to it, he kept changing it, updating it, but really it wasn't so much an interview in the end, it was very much a kind of autobiography and memoir. So he talks about writing in the present tense because narrators screw things up before your eyes. He says, "If a guilty conscience could ever rupture, I'd be in big trouble." He's always interested in the I narrator. This was something that quite a number of writers used in the 80s. He was always compared to Martin Amis and Ian McEwan. But of course, the identification with an I narrator is a very easy identification for the reader. You identify with this I narrator, and it's an easy identification. And what Clive does in his stories is just pull the rug out from under you. And this I narrator turns out to be some kind of sadist or fascist or rapist or that you thought was a perfectly okay individual. But so this is why he talks about writing in the present tense, writing and writing in the first person. Clive's version of Nathan Zuckerman, I think. I mean, he was, apart from anything else, a fantastic reader of and a fantastic reviewer of fiction, film, theatre, art. Again, I think he could give himself over to other people's work, which is again part of his character, not being completely ego-driven. And he talks about Zuckerman, Roth Zuckerman, he says, the Semite-obsessed writer Roth's Jewish detractors imagined him to be. If I was really, as they say, Roth seems to be thinking, what kind of mess would I be in? What kind of mess would I be in? And it's mess, it's the idea of being in a mess, it's messes here, it's boundary crossing, it's transgression, it's splits, bifurcations. It's that interests Clive and interested Clive about Roth's fiction, certainly in the 80s, certainly in this period. Now, Clive's ethical vision, I think, is as I've already said, is at the heart of his character and also his fiction. He talks about this Diaspora Blues in relation to his wife. He says, in relation to Fran, does she suspect that my real life is somewhere in a different country without her? But this is surely true of all writers, for we must invent our homelands where we spend the best part of our days utterly alone. So he's teasing out even here the extent to which he spends so much time away from his partner, the extent to which that is a betrayal. So he's teasing out the ethics of what it means to be a writer. There's a fantastic quote, the next quote, and it really is worth pondering over. He writes a book. So this is Clive not writing in the first person because he's writing about himself in the third person. He writes a book called The Lady with the Laptop. It includes a description of his wife's death. His wife had an aunt who drowned herself. She left her niece a fur coat. A friend, seeing it for the first time, asked, "What poor creature sacrificed itself to provide you with such a coat?" He couldn't help himself. "Her aunt," he said. His wife, not knowing whether to laugh or cry, did both. Now, if someone were to ask a similar question about his book, he would have to reply, "My wife." So you can see, you know, the seriousness with which he took his responsibility as a writer in relation to his nearest and dearest, as well as in relation to history, to those that victims of genocide that can no longer speak for themselves. I like this. I think Clive got a little bit queer towards the end of his life. Queer in the lit crit way, probably more than in any other way, but he certainly always poked fun. I mean, he wasn't a straightforward masculinist in the way that Roth was. And even here, just a little, this is another autobiographical piece. "Forgive me, my sisters of mercy, forgive my voyeuristic impulses, forgive my petty attempt to reassert my masculinity, to convince myself there's life in the odd dog." I won't say why he's asking for forgiveness, but I'll talk to Heidi about it afterwards. But I mean, I think quite a few of the masculine figures in his stories, I think always masculinity has been something that Clive has questioned, the too easy masculinity. And that's why some men that you might identify with turn into fascists or rapists or worse. Final quote, Does the world need another Holocaust memorial? This is something that Clive went public with. He wasn't comfortable at all about going public with a lot of things, but he did about around the Holocaust memorial. Our Seth, so this is from one of his articles. Seth is his son, and it was a diary of a single father. Certainly, I reply, they make people feel better. A man visits one of them. Okay, he thinks, I shouldn't have screwed my wife's best friend, but compared to what those bastards did to us, it was a good deal. I call this Dr. Sinclair's Law of Relativity. Now, in his early stories, he wrote just a short couple of pages on the Jewish Moral Bank. And the Jewish Moral Bank is essentially, if you belong to the Jewish Moral Bank, it means that you have enough moral credit to do what the fuck you like, basically. And I think that was Clive's position on all of this. Okay. So I'm now comparing the two of them as diasporists. The two of them as diasporists at this point. So by diaspora, I mean that a sense of them being outside of history, being a minority, powerless, having an ethical view of things. Also having a sense of the importance of textuality. So if you're outside of history, the textuality becomes incredibly important for both of them. And this is a quote that Clive also valued and used a lot. And it's from the anatomy lesson. So it's from the first Zuckerman trilogy of Philip Roth. So the first Zuckerman trilogy starts with The Ghostwriter, ends with The Prague Orgy, and you have, it's called Zuckerman Bound, and then you have Zuckerman Unbound and The Anatomy Lesson. So that's the first trilogy. The second trilogy is the American trilogy, and that's where we get the national term. But this is middle Roth, and this is Roth that I very much value, and Clive also valued. So Roth is essentially needs all kinds of physio for back trouble and can't do much else. And one of his physiotherapists is Jager from Poland in exile, from totalitarian Poland in exile, and has suffered a great deal. And he's contemplating, as he's kind of lying down, whether he could, and feeling sorry for himself, whether he could actually write a story called The Sorrows of Jager, about a woman exiled, as I say, from totalitarian rule. Now, Clive is incredibly generous about this. I'll read it, but what Clive says is that even though this argues that he can't do it, actually, it shows that he can. But let me read it. Hopeless, and not only because of the grass and the vodka. So he's high on marijuana, if you get high on marijuana. Is he low on marijuana? Probably. So, and vodka as well. If you get out of yourself, you can't be a writer because the personal ingredients is what gets you going. And if you hang on to the personal ingredients any longer, you'll disappear right up your asshole. So this is the solipsistic problem. This is what Roth actually called the crisis of solipsism, the crisis of trying to get out of yourself, get out of your own little world. Dante got out of hell easier than you'll escape Zuckerman Karnofsky. You don't want to represent her Warsaw. It's what her Warsaw represents that you want. Suffering that isn't semi-comical. The world of massive historical pain instead of this pain in the neck. War, destruction, anti-Semitism, totalitarianism, literature on which the fate of a culture hinges, writing at the very heart of the upheaval, a martyrdom, more to the point. Some point, any point, than bearing the cocktail party chit-chat as a guest on Dick Cavett. Chained to self-consciousness, chained to retrospection, chained to my dwarf drama till I die. On Dick Cavett, he turned up as a guest after Portnoy's complaint and there was a woman, fellow guest, and she refused to shake Roth's hand. Now, Philip Roth bifurcated. So this summarises the diasporic perspective. This summarises writing from the perspective of diaspora. So this is a standard quote of his. I've taken it from Shop Talk, but it goes back at least 20, 30 years. And I have to say, I suppose, and a very important thing, when Roth did live in London, he visited occupied Czech Republic, Prague, in particular, and did have first-hand contact with dissidents and writers that had lost their jobs and that were suffering. So he says, in Eastern Europe, nothing goes and everything matters. Here in the United States, everything goes and nothing matters. So this is the split that I think defines a diasporic perspective. And he writes about this when he looks back at his own work in Operation Shylock. He says, green lawns, white Jews, you, Roth, wrote about it. You crystallised it in your first book. That's what the hoopla was all about. 1959, so that, of course, is when Goodbye Columbus came out. The Jewish success story in its heyday. All new and thrilling and funny and fun. Liberated new Jews. Normalised Jews. Ridiculous and wonderful. The triumph of the untragic. The triumph of the untragic. Brenda Potemkin from Goodbye Columbus dethrones Anne Frank. So essentially he's setting up a view of his work as a comic narrative, going really up until Sabbath Theatre, 1995. The triumph of the untragic, Jews as white, no longer victims. Again, we have an absolute divide between different kinds of histories. In the third quote, we're anything but the duplicates that everyone is suppose you and me to be, because Aaron, so this is Aaron Appelfeld, the great Israeli writer who survived the war in the forests of Eastern Europe as a child. Aaron and I each embody the reverse of the other's experience, because each recognises in the other, the Jewish man, that he is not, because of the orbiting compatible orientations that shape our very different lives and very different books, and that result from antithetical 20th century Jewish biographies, because we're the heirs jointly of a drastically bifurcated legacy. And again, the question of textuality here. George Steiner wrote a famous essay, My Homeland, the Text. My Homeland, the Text. If you want a manifesto, I mean, I know that Kitai did his a diasporous manifesto, but George Steiner was there first with My Homeland, the Text. The pride inspired in my parents by the establishment in 1948 of a homeland in Palestine that would gather in the unmurdered remnant of a European Jewry was, in fact, not so unlike that what welled up in me when I first came upon Lonoff's thwarted secret imprisoned souls. Lonoff is a version, I think, of Bernard Malamud, a writer that is a wonderful writer, but very much escaped monumental history, escaped the Holocaust, escaped Eastern Europe. And so what you're left with is thwarted, secretive, imprisoned souls. But it's this replacement of national pride for pride in his stories. If you like, textual pride. Pride in textuality. Oh boy, I'm just looking at the clock. Okay. Yeah, now there's one thing that's not happening here. Okay. I've suddenly realised what's not happening. And when I said the end of the introductions, then it should have been a, look, this. the diasporic turn. We've now got the national turn, folks. But this isn't saying it. Look, national turn, okay? So it seems as if it's just a PowerPoint stream of consciousness. Well, actually, there's meant to be slides interrupting. So this is now completely different. So I've given you three introductions. We've talked about a diasporic sensibility in both Roth and Sinclair and Clive. Now things change, and this is when I think Clive and Roth radically differ. So instead of bifurcation, we get unbifurcation. Nothing now is bifurcated. Everything comes together. And this, I'm talking about post Sabbath Theatre, so post-1995, in the second Zuckerman trilogy, the American trilogy. So it's made up of I Married a Communist, The Human Stain, and American Pastoral. Thank you, David. So that's the second trilogy. So now suddenly everything comes together. Nothing is bifurcated. So in the first quote, there's a kind of clue here. To become a new being, to bifurcate, the drama that underlines America's story, the high drama that is upping and leaving, and the energy and cruelty that rapturous drive depends on, demands. So to bifurcate now becomes America's story. It's purely American issue. It happens purely within the boundary, the national boundary of America. And it's absolutely to do with America's story, American history. So Roth now ceases to be a diasporic writer and becomes an American writer, and an American national writer. And again, history had been scaled down and personalised. America had been scaled down and personalised. You flood into history, and history floods into you. You flood into America, and America floods into you. Now, this is Zuckerman's talking about Ira Ringgold, the hero of I Married a Communist. So now history becomes part of Roth's heroes. History isn't elsewhere. It's not. We have none of the issues around the sorrows of Shago. It's very much part of America and what America means. Again, he has different versions of history. So in The Plot Against America, he says, history is everything that happens elsewhere, even here in Newark, even here in Newark. So everything, history is universalised. History isn't elsewhere. It's something that happens even in Newark, even in the smallest inconsequential places in America. So history claims everybody, whether they like it or not. And that was the story behind The Plot Against America. The terror of the unforeseen is what the science of history hides, turning a disaster into an epic. So again, history here isn't just universalized in America. It's also becomes and begins to be monumentalized. It becomes terror. And the last quote I couldn't resist. And this is the first context for The Plot Against America. There are several contexts. The first context was George W. Bush. Obviously, it's had a new lease of life, The Plot Against America, in relation to Donald Trump. But in terms of George W. Bush, you can see there's no real difference. Aristophanes, who surely must be God, is given as George W. Bush. A man unfit to run a hardware store, let alone a nation like this one, and who has merely reaffirmed the maxim that informed the writing of all these books and makes our lives as Americans as precarious as anyone else's. All assurances are provisional, even here, in a 200-year-old democracy. We're ambushed by the unpredictability. That is history. So history has come home to America. It's unpredictable. It threatens the values of America. History is no longer elsewhere. Monumental history, we'll see, is no longer elsewhere. And just a very quick summary of this argument. So in The Sorrows of Jaeger, he talks about war, destruction, anti-Semitism, totalitarianism, literature on which the fate of a culture hinges. He's chained to his dwarf drama as a diasporist. It's this kind of monumental history he wants to write about. Destruction, totalitarianism. So, he does. Common Silk is a great man brought low with suffering. He's like Nixon at San Clemente. Is that right?
Clemente.
So here we have racial politics in America, the question of passing, but also the link here with past presidents, and he tends to do this a lot in his fiction. Lvov in American Pastoral is known as our Jewish Kennedy, and that's about post-war Americanization and suburbanization, as well as the Vietnam War and terrorism as well. So big historical subjects in the American trilogy. Ira Ringgold, who I've already quoted from, is renowned throughout for his close physical similarity to Abraham Lincoln. But the whole book there is about McCarthyism, totalitarianism. The traumatic effects of the Vietnam War, again in the human stain as well as the American pastoral. The Korean War and the indignation is very much part of the novella's background. The Second World War and plot against America, and we know an alternative quasi-fascist president. And Anne Frank reappears much less ambiguously in Exit Ghost, 2007. And finally, polio and death in Everyman. Everyman is a medieval mystery tale. Death is universalised. So death, suffering, all the big questions are in his American trilogy, and he becomes very much an American writer. Now, Clive, completely different trajectory. So America for Clive, and not just America, but every single national state, I would say, every single... He takes quite literally the description of nation states as imagined communities. So all of Clive's national states are imagined communities, first and foremost. So your Israelite, my America, is a state of mind, a state of mind. My methods are impressionistic. These two quotes here are very much Clive actually talking about his own literary methods. My methods are impressionistic. I'm like a heroic painter who somehow manages to extract moments of dramatic action from terrain that was already highly charged. So this is set in the Middle East, in Israel-Palestine. Adds causes and the consequences, which are present anyway. All I need is my imagination to pick up on them. And pretty soon the land is peopled by ghosts. The land is peopled by ghosts. I was making a lot of ghost jokes in the lead up to this talk, but sadly the chairs aren't nailed down. So. Every people has its stories, which is not the same as its history. It is this story that roots them to the land that sustains their art sense of identity. It may not be the truth, but it's believed. I've lived my life in the 20th century. I'm not ignorant of the importance of truth, but I'm an artist and my first responsibility is to the story. So Clive very much puts narrative ahead of nation. And he always was a fantastic traveller. All over the United States, down to Mexico, Israel, Egypt, Jordan, as well as Eastern Europe. And he imagines stories in these national spaces. It was as though the radio was observing the world in a mirror. Thus it calmly informs us. So he has these imagined places, Ashkenazia, from his early stories up until his later stories. Ashkenazia had invaded Ishmaelia. And the citizens of St. Albans, are known confusedly as Albanians. But after the advent of the University of St. Albans, which of course he calls USA, they're known as New Albanians. So America, in an early story on America, when I was little, I thought America was preceded by the indefinite article. Again, we have his version of the inner cowboy is just taking his first tentative steps. And Clive Sinclair says that he was always in search for his inner cowboy. Again, it must come as something of a culture shock to hear a cowboy speaking fluent German, but then so did half of the United States back in the 19th century. If the English language hadn't triumphed, there could well have been a second Anschluss, a transatlantic alliance between a German-speaking America and Hitler's European Empire. Of course, Philip Roth toyed with such a fantasy in The Plot Against America. But I think, again, Clive has a wonderful reading of this novel. Roth chickens out in The Plot Against America. He couldn't bring himself to imagine a Holocaust when his friends Primo Levi and Aaron Appelfeld had lived through the real thing. And I think he's right that even though you have a kind of fascist America, he only goes so far in relation to the analogy, in relation to the genocidal analogy, that he can't actually go the full hog, if you'll excuse the expression, with the genocidal analogy. And Roth couldn't, because he knows what the real thing is. He knows what the actual history is. And finally, as I say, I think we can oppose monumental history and this attempt at monumental history, the attempt at the great American novel, with something much more modest, much more achievable, in the last quote, by some miracle, Dodge City's historic front street survived well into the 1970s. By then, a Disney-style replica had been established near the supposed site of Boot Hill and was shamelessly billed as historic old Front Street. The facsimile masqueraded as the real thing. With such a replica, who needed the original? Hence, dodgy realism. So Clive, a lot of his late work, such as True Tales of the Wild West, but also Death in Texas, plays a lot with the idea of dodgy realism, that replicas, stories, narratives are as important as the real thing, the original. Now, this is a quote from Death in Texas, which I think is an example of what I call lyrical dodgy realism at its very best. Dogwood is blossoming on the banks of the Nolichucky. A few feet away stands the cabin in which Davy Crockett was born. The sun is low, the museum locked, and the place deserted. Feldman is aware that this one-room country shack isn't the original, is in fact the second replica on the site. The first having been declared too fanciful and demolished, but it will suffice. Its chimney is built of brick, its walls of logs. Dovetails join front and sides. Peeping through the door, Feldman notes an authentic-looking bearskin nailed to the back wall. Now here, I think, is an analogy with The Sorrows of Jaeger, just as Roth shows he could write about elsewhere if he really wanted to. Clive here, I think, is showing a wonderful lyricism which came into his late stories the two Death and Texas and Charlotte Must Die, and shows that he can absolutely write lyrically and authentically about the Wild West. Okay, now this is meant to say, you'll be glad to see, conclusion! And there's only one conclusion. So the intros win 3-1. Ah! And it's there! I did a big build-up and it's there. Now why the others disappeared, I've no idea. Okay, main points. Just one slide, folks. Main points. Clive Sinclair is a diasporic writer. Philip Roth was a diasporic writer until his American trilogy or national term. So I asked the question, what is lost and gained by such a term? Sinclair maintained a minority position, distanced from monumental history and national boundaries. Again, what's lost and gained by such consistency? Diaspora can be deeply conservative and also transgressive. So the important thing, you know, if you divide the world up into authentic, pure homelands, and then people exiled from these authentic, pure homelands, that's a very conservative way, with a small C, of thinking of the world. But if you think of the world made up of lots of exiles, lots of people who moved about and have always moved about, and that these pure homelands have always been made up of people who move about, then it's much more transgressive. And Clive was very much a transgressive diasporist. There's also, I think, an ethics at the heart of diasporic writing. Both in terms of Clive's character, his friendships, his lifelong friendships across time, space, and generations, that he valued and thought carefully about the effects of writing on people. The limits of representation. So I think Clive was aware of the extent to which the Holocaust totalitarianism actually limited his imagination, which I think once you just assume that this is part of a monumental history that you kind of assimilate or adopt, then there's a very different sense of limits and limitations. Friendship, conviviality, the value of relationships beyond the text, as I say, and imagined rather than historical communities. History is narrative, although again, not everything can be turned into a text. And it's this struggle that Clive has between, on the one hand, thinking of history as a narrative and acknowledging that not everything is a text and can be turned into a text. Okay, got there. Thank you.